you close the door behind you? Were you walking in your sleep, or were you just too tired to notice all the watchful eyes upon you? There's the man who does the maintenance and the maid who cleans the carpets in the hall, and the guard down in the lobby through a hidden TV camera saw it all.
Insurgent Radio Network calling. Insurgent Radio Network calling. This is Terrible Tommy, Tom Metzger, in the bunker right here in north central Indiana on an overcast and a little bit drizzly day here. It's cooling off. Yeah, that weather change is starting to catch up with us, boys and girls. I hear it's going to even get a little cooler. Whoa, in the middle of the summer. How about that? Well, it's July the 23rd, 2014, and it's Wotan's Day, David Lane's favorite day. Got a question for you, okay? How many American citizens would you estimate that are fighting and serving the IDF forces in Israel right now? Do you think it's 100? 500? 1,500? 2,000. Yep, over 2,000 Americans, U.S. citizens, are fighting on the side of the IDF in Israel. And probably right now they're over there kicking the ass of the Palestinians. Or Jesus. No. Well, yeah, they're probably, some of these are evangelicals, Christian Zionists, probably most of them are, thinking they're doing the Lord's work by helping the Jews out over there while the Jews stay home. U.S. citizens can go out and kick the ass of the Palestinians. Interesting, huh? I used to think there was some kind of law about that it was not legal to serve the forces of another military, a foreign military. But, of course, that doesn't mean anything when it comes to the Jews, of course. They fall under a whole different set of rules. Well, let's see here. Let's get into our classes today. Tension class. Let's talk about AIDS for a while here. Out of Carlos Porter's book, his new book. In the 19th century, an English merchant contracted to deliver one grain of wheat, the number of grains to double every day until the contract expired. He then discovered that he had contracted to deliver more wheat than existed anywhere in the world, more, in fact, than all the world's grain supplies put together. The contract was declared null and void. This little swindle was based on the curious phenomenon of mathematics called exponential doubling. It works this way. If you take the number 1 and double it 10 times, it comes to more than 1,000. Double it 20 times, and it comes to more than 1,000,000. You double it 30 times, it comes to more than 1,000,000,000. Let us take the two other examples. A, if there are 1 billion non-whites in the world, using the figure 1 to simplify the calculation, and their numbers double every 20 years, in 200 years there will be 1 trillion non-whites. In 400 years, there will be a quadrillion non-whites. B, if there are 1 million AIDS cases in the world, and the number doubles every 12 months, and every case takes an average of 5 years to die, there will be nobody left alive in the world by AD 2020. It is obvious that these two extrapolations, I always get screwed up on that, extrapolations contradict each other, and that projection B is just about the only possibility of forestalling projection A. Regarding A, it has been calculated by computer that the present rate of increase, the total mass of non-white humanity, will equal the mass of the Earth by AD 3530 and will expand to fill the whole known universe, 15 billion light years across, by AD 6826. According to the liberals and the race mixers, this universe of parasitic scum are all equal to us. They must all be provided with a modern standard of living at our expense. But they owe us nothing in return. Regarding B, it is not exactly true that no one would be left alive. AIDS is a communicable disease of the Negro race. The non-white races, the racially mixed, and all persons that mix with Negroes, Hispanics, Jews, race mixers, drug addicts, homosexuals, and so on. Among whites, it's estimated that 5% of the Italians and 14% of the Swedes are in fact racially immune to AIDS. They're said to possess the G2 fast gene, exclusive to certain members of the white race, and providing full immunity if passed on by both parents. Since AIDS is a disease of minority groups, the only concern of the liberals, predictably enough, is to protect their civil rights. Carriers must therefore be exempt from all laws applying to the carriers of other diseases, such as syphilis or typhoid. Insurance companies must be prohibited from asking any questions designed to determine whether or not an individual may or may not be a carrier. All laws against homosexuality, homosexual activity, no matter how lenient, must be abolished. Negroes must be encouraged to screw white girls at all costs. No problem. Liberalism is a form of progressive mental illness, which may be defined as a form of moral coprophilia. The liberals will do anything, even die horribly, rather than abandon the philosophy of human equality. AIDS carriers must be protected from discrimination. They must be included. They must be integrated. We must overcome our reaction of fear and rejection. No problem. In 1991, in the university city of Coimbra, Portugal, the editor of a student newspaper wrote an article in which he asserted that 5% of all African students had tested positive for AIDS. Correct percentage of African carriers, probably 20 to 30%. The result was a panic in which the Africans were kicked out of their lodgings and refused services in cafes. Eating utensils used by the Africans were smashed. The response of the liberals was typical. The student editor was expelled from the school. The problem was declared solved. No problem. The only problem, say the liberals, is persuading people to use condoms, a device believed in normal use to be only 70 to 90% preventing pregnancy, and which certainly cannot prevent the passing of much smaller virus. No problem. In Germany and Luxembourg, kindergartners were compelled to color posters saying, this is in German, but what it means is love goes through the rubber, AIDS doesn't. An injunction which will presumably be kept in mind when millions of public-spirited Turkish and Congolese pimps, drug pushers, and rapists. No problem. Freud believed that there was a connection between repression and neurosis. Perhaps this is why our Western democracies are the most neurotic societies in the history of the world, characterized by an all-pervading atmosphere of nameless fear. The possession of heroin was legalized in Holland and Spain, while the sale of chewing tobacco and snuff became a crime in Belgium, Britain, and Ireland. Tobacco products cause cancer, a disease which isn't even catching. That's terrible. The worship of homosexuals was made a de facto state religion despite their known role as major vectors of numerous diseases, including an incurable, fatal, symptomless illness, while hysterical demands were being made that genetically engineered foods be specifically labeled and even prohibited. The importation of such foods was actually prohibited in Luxembourg and Austria, in an atmosphere of media panic and emergency legislation. You might eat something with genetically engineered soybeans in it. That's terrible. Note, actually, the anti-genetic engineering people were quite right, but note that we are only allowed to worry about things as long as they are purely theoretical. When they materialize, they are ignored, and something else is invented. A panic. A day keeps the half-wits at bay. A panic a day. Liberalism and AIDS are the collision between the immovable object and the irresistible force. In attempting to contain the explosion, the liberals are only increasing its violence. The revolution is coming. You can join us and set up an authoritarian system of applied racial science, which means national socialism, or you can die. Since AIDS promises to wipe out the race mixers, it follows that AIDS is a white man's best friend. The way things are going, we might end up alone on the planet, reduced in numbers perhaps, but of distinctly higher quality, having learned a lesson or two. It therefore follows that the scientists and researchers working on a cure for AIDS are the world's worst threat to the white race survival and should be dealt with as race traitors. Well, I think we got rid of a few of them on that plane that went down over in the Ukraine. Liberals have never hesitated to take their principles to any extreme, no matter how irrational and insane. They instinctively fear that the inapplicable of the equality principle to any group of people threatens the principle itself, so it must be infinitely extended. In the 1940s, the liberals told us there was no difference between Jews and non-Jews. It became a crime to say that Jews hijacked the country and caused the war. It became Nazi propaganda to say that the gas chambers were an invention of Allied propaganda. In the 1950s and 60s, the liberals told us there was no difference between the races. It became a crime to discriminate, even when the Negro master race robbed, raped, and beat up our friends and relatives and wrecked our schools and neighborhoods. Since sexual differences are a reminder of racial differences, the liberals told us there was no difference between men and women. It became a crime in France to advertise for air hostesses. Since national differences are a reminder of racial differences, the liberals told us there was no difference between nationalities. It became a crime in Holland to advertise a job for applicants who could speak Dutch. Since the differences between homo and heterosexuals are a reminder of differences between men and women, which in turn are a reminder of racial and national differences. The liberals told us there was no difference between homo and heterosexuals. It became a crime to discriminate against homosexuals. It then transpired that 50% of the homosexuals in San Francisco, to cite only one example, were already infected. The liberals were undaunted. They took their principle one step further. They told us there was no difference between AIDS carriers and non-carriers, because only 10% of all carriers were developing the disease. No problem. It became a crime to discriminate against AIDS carriers, closing your doors to the carriers of a fatal, incurable, and contagious illness. How pitiless, how cruel. It then transpired that nearly 100% of AIDS carriers were developing the disease sooner or later, regardless of all the living with AIDS propaganda nonsense. The liberals were undaunted. As always, they took their principle one step further. They told us there is no difference between homosexuals who had already developed the disease and others who hadn't so far. It became a crime in Great Britain and elsewhere to fire terminally ill AIDS cases from their jobs. It is now known that the carriers are developing the disease at a rate of 100%. And dying at a rate of 100%, unless something else kills them first. Usually the cause of death is falsified by attributing it to pneumonia or TB. The bright side is that the longer they live, the more people they infect. This puts the liberals in a quandary. To be logically consistent, they must now argue that there is no difference between homosexuals who are still alive and others who have already died of the disease, that there is no difference between the living and the dead. This suggests the possibility of integration with dead people. Integration may take place in two directions. The liberals can dig up their dead friends and integrate with them in the privacy of their own homes, which is impossible since AIDS victims are always cremated. Or the liberals can be bused to the cemeteries and integrated with their dead friends there. We prefer the latter option. This solves the problem, since integration is a civil matter. The safeguards of criminal law do not apply. Integration may be hazardous to your health, but it is not a matter of criminal law. Thus, we need do when the revolution comes, is to issue an integration order, followed upon failure to comply by an implementation order, to be carried out within 24 hours plus cost. A disclaimer, I am not saying that the scientists working for an AIDS cure should be hunted down and killed like abortionists. That would be murder. Murder is against the law. That is out of the question. But they can be implemented. After all, the liberals themselves have taught us that when we take something and give it a different name, it becomes something different. For example, that affirmative action is not discrimination, or a fetus is not a human being. This far, it would appear that AIDS is failing to live up to its promises, so brightly announced 15 or even 20 years ago, but it works in a mysterious way in wonders to perform. 15 years ago, it was calculated in the United States and Germany that 0.5% of all Army recruits were already infected. Worldwide, that would be 30 million people. It was then discovered in anonymous public hospital emergency room testing that probably 25% of all male Negroes in New York City aged 20 to 35 were already infected. American Negroes are believed to be acquiring new cases at 14 times the rate of whites and to be 5 times as infectious. Between 8 and 10 years ago, the AIDS infection rate in Central Africa, Rwanda and Burundi, and so on, was estimated at 50%, while in Southern Africa, Rhodesia, Malawi, Zambia, and so forth, is estimated at 20 to 25%. It is believed to be 13% in South Africa right now. The infection rate in the Congo is now believed to have approached 100%. This is not so unlikely as it may appear. the rate of infection among voluntarily tested members of the South African Defense Forces about 5 years ago was reliably stated to have been 89%. Similar statistics are available for Zambia and Rhodesia, a.k.a. Zimbabwe. In the United States, 52% of the cases of all new cases are believed to involve non-whites. Over 80% of all cases are now believed to involve blacks, Hispanics, drug addicts, race mixers, faggots, and so forth. In 2001, this prestigious Robert Koch Institute in Germany estimated that up to 40% of all Africans were infected, but that the infection rate among homosexuals in Germany was far higher. Let us assume that there are only 25 million carriers in the world, an estimate which must be viewed as absurdly conservative, since it's officially admitted that 13 million Africans have already died, an estimate which must again be viewed as absurdly conservative in view of the deliberate official policy of distortion of all information relating to the topic, and since it is simultaneously claimed that the entire African villages have lost all their adults, that all the surviving children in those villages are AIDS orphans, that the entire rural districts have become depopulated, and so on and so on. Let us further assume that every AIDS carrier infects only one other person over a period of 2 years, and never anyone else. Another absurdly conservative assumption. Remember, Rock Hudson, for example, is believed to have infected hundreds of people, although he knew he was dying of the disease. The total number of infected persons will reach 6.4 billion people in only 16 years, if not much sooner. That is the mathematical results of doubling the number 25 million 8 times over. Assuming that there are 100 million carriers, which is probably far more realistic, the figure of 6.4 billion AIDS carriers will be reached in only 6 doublings. The question now arises, can the AIDS infection rate double 8 or even 6 times in 16 years? The answer is that it appears to have done so in many cases already. In Massachusetts in 1982, there were only 45 AIDS cases in the entire state. 12 years later, there were 10,000 AIDS cases, i.e. the number 45 doubled 8 times equal 90, 180, 360, 720, 1440, 2880, 5760, 11,520 cases. 10,000 AIDS cases in Massachusetts doubled another 8 times in 12 years would be 12.8 million AIDS cases in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts alone. That is the effect of exponential doubling. It should be borne in mind that any self-respecting crack addict or homosexual should be able to infect at least one or two people every other drunken weekend, while it takes a good 13 years for even the most sexually active Negro to reproduce and breed another Negro to reproduction rapist age, i.e. 2 generations in 26 years. It may be objected that the population of the world may well double while the AIDS carriers in question, the Congolese aforesaid, whether resident in the Congo or the idiot kingdom of Belgium, are still alive, but many of these children will undoubtedly be carriers. Even in this case, one more doubling and the total number of infected persons would be 12.8 billion. How long does it take to infect one person with AIDS? That's how fast the total number can double in theory. In The War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells, Martian invaders conquered the Earth with death rays and poison gas only to be destroyed by Earth's bacteria. The AIDS infection rate will undoubtedly explode as it becomes increasingly difficult to avoid infected persons, as with leprosy or TB. When one considers that AIDS-related complex is not even counted at AIDS, although it is caused by the same virus, that we are concerned only with carriers and not fully developed cases, since the carriers will inevitably die unless something else kills them first. And the longer they live, the more people they will infect. The picture becomes almost optimistic. The idiocy of liberals is playing into the hands in this way, if no other. Last but not least, many other new improved diseases such as West Nile virus, Ebola virus, galloping gangrene, Legionnaire's disease, Marburg virus, and so on are also said to be appearing at the rate of one per year. Who says there's no order in the universe? That these new viruses appear to have killed very few people so far should not cause us to despair. To this must be added the scenario of trillions of dollars of bad debt in the world. There will not be the money to keep AIDS carriers alive artificially, or to treat all their other diseases. The AIDS virus is continually mutating and appearing quite likely to become increasingly resistant to drugs at all. What we really need is for it to become more contagious, but that's possible as well. The phenomenon of exponential doubling is also the basis for many gambling schemes, the most successful of which is probably the one dignified with the name in gambling parlance of the paroli mizi, I can't even pronounce that, doubling your bet when you're winning, then withdrawing part of the bet. For example, you're betting on a black on roulette. You try to win three bets in a row, leaving the bet on the table, then withdraw the bet if you win, and go back to betting the minimum. For example, if you bet $1 three times in a row and lose, you have lost $3. If you win three times in a row, you have won $7. There are now $8 on the table in front of you, but one of them is already yours. If you lose four bets in a row, you have lost $4. But if you win four bets in a row, you've won $15. There are now $16 on the table in front of you, but one of them was already yours. This can be quite spectacular in a short term. In the long run, of course, you will do no better than the law of averages minus the house percentages, i.e., you will lose. Keep in mind that the table limit will probably be 25 times the minimum bet, $25 if you're betting $1. Albert Einstein advocated doubling your bet when you are losing, i.e., after six bets of $1, you will be betting $32 to win $1, which will not work anyway because of the table limit of 25 times the minimum bet, i.e. $25. This means that if you lose five bets in a row, you're finished. This technique is called the paroli mizi in avant, and casinos love it. That's one reason why I do not believe in the theory of relativity. I have no confidence in the author as a gambler. That's enough for today, boys and girls. We'll do it again, but there you see, and then we're going to get into just exactly how horrible it is becoming in Africa. I mean, even worse than what the newspapers talk about. And we'll get into that in another show. This is why I say over and over, don't get pessimistic. Don't get so negative like the right-wing conservatives and all these so-called racial groups that it's all over. We're through. Well, you know, millions and millions and millions died in Europe back in the medieval days. And in fact, it improved our race rather than destroying it. But I've said all along, our greatest benefactor is Mother Nature herself. And the worst enemy of these predatory capitalists and these race mixers and these liberals is nature, because they, even their religions, the Abrahamic religions, hate nature. They want to defy nature all the time, and you're not going to defy nature very long. It's going to catch you and kick you in the ass really good. So no matter what they do and no matter how much they spend on race mixing programs and everything else that they do that's totally crazy, they're going to get it. They're going to get it. So why don't you join with me? And even though I tend to be a little cynical now and then about a lot of things, but you deserve to be optimistic on this issue because it's reality. And J.B. Stoner was entirely correct when he was preaching Thank God for AIDS 25 years ago, maybe 30 years ago. And he was ridiculed from one end of the country to the other. But they did put him on TV quite a bit where he could say, thank God for AIDS. So I can just see old J.B. Stoner, who used to be one of the heads of the National States Rights Party and a friend of the Klan and a hardcore Southern unrepentant white racist. I can just see him smiling right now, man. In his coffin, he's laying there with a smile on his face. Yeah, that away, J.B. Even our own people ridiculed J.B. If they thought, well, maybe his predictions were right, they thought, oh, you're too crude, because when J.B. gave a speech, he might be talking about AIDS and like that. But he'd always use the term nigger. And back in the old days when I first got involved in this, I would cringe at him always saying AIDS. I mean, nigger. I say, well, oh, we'll never be able to recruit the masses by saying nigger. I have discovered that the fact that we don't use the term nigger is one of the ways that our enemies can see how oppressed mentally they have us. You know, because our enemies have no problem saying horrible things and labeling us with non-truth labels and all that kind of stuff. But you can't say nigger because that's going to offend people. So what? I want to offend them. I want to offend them every day. And it was difficult for me to begin to use the term nigger on a regular basis because I was never taught that in a home. We did not, number one, we did not have niggers around where I lived, around this area. There's quite a few now, but we didn't have them then. And so, my parents, well, why did you didn't really have to be hardcore racist if there's just white people around. I mean, you got to be racist when there's non-whites around. When your neighbors and everybody in the town is all white, you got no reason to be, you know, racist. And the point is, you don't need a injection into your immune system like a flu shot till there's a danger of a lot of flu coming on. Now, I haven't had the flu for 15 years, but still, I think it's probably wise to get a shot. But racism is immunization, and you got to have it. And you got to, even if it's not to affect other people, you got to remind yourself, if you can, even in the quietness of your own house, your backyard or your barn, nigger, 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 just to make you feel better. What do we care? They're never going to call us, these liberal types and these conservatives, they're never going to call us good, nice names. They hate our guts, man. They hate our guts. So let's get it out in the open. Keep it out in the open. And even at the pain of death to those bastards, go down screaming, nigger, nigger, nigger. Kite, 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 kite. You don't like it? Piss on you. So that's the reason why you don't have to go out and start blowing away Negroes, niggers on the corner, and things like that. Because nature's going to take care of it. Just be patient. You don't have to do 50, 75 years in prison. it's going to be taken care of. Inside the prisons, it's being taken care of. Where the infection rate inside the prison among blacks is very, very high. So just go around with a smile on your face. And it'll drive them crazy, man. And the beauty of taking that position on nigger and everything else is they can't really do anything about it. Now, you got to be careful on the job. You don't want to lose your job to make enough money to feed your family. But I'm generally speaking, we're talking about. And also, write these figures down, too, and show them to your liberal friends. Say, look, in 20 years or 25, 100 years, they're not going to be any Negroes around. What do you mean, you racist son of a bitch? Well, look at these figures. Figure it out. Figure it out. Yeah. Hey, happy days, man. Happy days. Well, now let me look around the web here and see if I can find some more good news for you today. I want you people to be happy. I don't want you to go around with a long face all the time. Well, let's look into the All-American Terrorism, the CIA, and being recruited into the CIA. How does that work? Let's listen to this.
You went from a clean upbringing into a world of dirty tricks in your mature life.
Yeah. But the key thing is that as you get recruited into the CIA, it never occurs to you that if you're as naive as I was, and I think most of the young men that come into the CIA are, it never occurs to you that you're getting into a world of dirty tricks. The things they use to sell is that you're finally getting into the elite inner circles of the United States government. All your life you've been going through the amateurs and the prelims and the prep schools, in effect, and finally this is it. This is where the people are real pros, the frontline warriors saving the nation from communism. The Phoenix program was created by the CIA, and its purpose was to kill and terrorize. In Vietnam, I was forced to do business with a police chief who was a sadistic mutilator of prisoners. He liked to carve them up and throw the remains in the river. And he was completely paid and propped up by the CIA. His whole career depended on, one, controlling that operation so that the CIA needed him, and two, the CIA propping him up and funding him. And he did his knife work in a CIA safe house. We called it the Pink House. I reported this to the chief of station, and he said, well, you know, it's a rough world, and sometimes you have to do business with people that really aren't your first choice of the kind of people you want to associate with, so don't make a wave. And so I went back, you know, what do? Resign my post? Yeah, you know, that's obviously, that's your last vote, though. You resign and you're out. And I wasn't ready to give up my career yet. I terminated the safe house. I told case officers that I don't want to hear about it. If this guy has a compulsion to do this sort of thing anymore, I don't want to hear about it.
How does the CIA go about recruiting its future candidates for officers and agents?
Hmm. Have any of y'all been approached here? Has the recruiters come through here and talked to you?
No, somebody
in this room might be sweating right now because he's been told, you know, if they ask you, don't say anything.
I hear that they do use professors to keep eyes out in their classes for particular students who might be interested in that sort of work. But I wonder how, were you approached here at the university or were you approached sometime later in your career?
At the university, a CIA recruiter came through. I went and talked to them. He did not write my name down. And in early 64, I got a letter in the mail saying, would I mind if the CIA did a security check? And I wrote back saying, I was restless, and I wrote back saying I'd be delighted if it was for possible employment. With my background, there were fields where I would be unique. From the Congo, I went to the University of Texas and enrolled in the ROTC program. I graduated in 1959 and took a commission in the Marine Corps. I didn't see my future as a career officer, so when my term was up, I accepted an offer as a junior executive at the Gates Rubber Company and went with my family to Colorado.
Where
We were very young and idealistic with three children when the CIA first approached us. We were in the Marine Corps for 3 years and did not want to go the military route, although there was a very promising career there. When you think about his job being a career or national security, I think that at the time the emphasis was career. I think that most of what he did was for the next fitness report, so to speak. I think that people generate activity that is unnecessary overseas in order to have some activity on their fitness report, and they really don't get promoted within the CIA unless they have so many recruitments, let's say, in a tour of duty, or so many operations, or ops, as they call them.
The way the CIA works, you're promoted on the basis of your fitness report, which you get every few months or at the end of every assignment, at least once a year, usually more often. And this evaluates your performance both with a letter grade and also a written narrative. That and the assignments you get will develop your career.
I said, why don't you just go in there and tell them that this is immoral and this is something you can't do? And he said, well, they don't want, you're not going to get anywhere in your career if you say no to assignments. And by that time, though, he was hooked by the CIA, and the assignments were sexy assignments and interesting assignments.
In one post, we put 7 bugs in a foreign embassy. It was quite dramatic and very exciting, and we had officers and support officers and technicians flying all over Africa on this thing, and we got them in. Of the 7 bugs that we installed clean, we never got caught, 5 of them never came up on the air. They were totally defective. The 6th one would transmit, but the switch, the activator to shut off the thing when no one was speaking was defective, so it burned out its batteries in the course of about 6 weeks' time and went off the air. And one of them functioned properly. And that one, although it was in an ambassador's office of a country that was very much a target of intelligence activities, that one never produced a single disseminable report. And I felt like I was really making time professionally. I was a very young officer when I met my first president. We had a mutual interest. There were things I could do for him, and there were things he could do for us, at least in terms of making me feel secure in his country. If I was meeting him and he appreciated what I was doing for him, it wasn't likely that he was going to throw me out if I made a mistake or got caught. And it was pretty heady stuff for a very young officer. And it meant that I was getting recognition back at headquarters, obviously. You know, there's young Stockwell who's meeting President X. And we better keep our eye on Stockwell. He looks good.
My function at home when agents would come to the home would be to turn on the record player and be sure that the curtains were closed and that there was enough security in my own home that the person wouldn't, you know, be compromised by having come to our home. I didn't really, at that time, I didn't realize that we would be putting these people in danger and that some would be put in jail and that some would be dead.
A lot of other things happen in the world that's sort of like somebody pushing a rock off the cliff, and the rock hits somebody, and then, you know, they step back and say, I didn't kill him, the rock killed him. And this is sort of what happened in Ghana. The agency, to my knowledge, did not write a paper saying, let's overthrow Nkrumah. The chief of station there was a very aggressive man, and he became aware of the fact that there was the possibility of a coup developing, and he knew the players, people who in the army who were unhappy, and he began to report and to ask for encouragement, to encourage these men. And as I understand it, he was not given a formal permission to attempt to overthrow Nkrumah, but he was given permission to monitor the developments of any coup, and this gave him an excuse to meet these officers often, daily, several times a day, and to give them money, and in effect to give them encouragement. A soft file is a file that doesn't have an official name on it or cryptonym on it, and is not registered into the agency's IBM system, the system of 201 numbers, so that it can't be traced. If you come to the agency demanding to see your file, And if they have a soft file on you instead of a 201, you'll never get it. They may have a manila folder in there with reams of documents about you, and you'll never get access to it.
There were times when I said, well, let's just get out of the CIA. You know, Bob, really you're making a decision which is, it's getting to the point where it's going to be the CIA or it's going to be our marriage. And he chose the CIA.
Well, now, if you haven't been hanging around right-wing meetings and joining these Hollywood this and Hollywood that guys, and if you've kept sort of a low profile and would like to turn the tables and be a lone wolf inside the CIA, you might want to pursue that type of career. You can get a degree that CIA officers get. This evidently is from an educational group called henley-putnam.edu. henley-putnam, putnam.edu. And I'm sure you can research that and find out some of the things you'll need to know. Wouldn't it be nice to be turning the tables on some of these people? I think so. But if you approach them in any way and they have any kind of information on you at all, being involved in right wing, they might like you, because right wingers a lot of times make pretty good agents. But as far as being a white racist, anything like that, or belonging to any group, you might as well forget it. Over the years, I've had some contact with individuals who have been involved in that kind of activity. One was a contract FBI agent that used to feed me a lot of information. By the time he was talking to me, he was officially out of it. But he knew a lot of things, and he knew everything about J. Edgar Hoover and his homosexual affairs and all that kind of stuff. And then, if you remember Casey, who was the head of the CIA for some time until he turned up dead, he had a brain tumor or something very suspicious. You know, these leaders of the CIA, they turn up dead every once in a while. But anyhow, this guy used to call me once in a while, not Casey, but one of his, he was one of Casey's ponies, he called himself. Casey had the inside track on stock, to where they were passing this information on to a select bunch of retired CIA men, and they were making a lot of money on it. And he used to call me once in a while. He never actually made an overt offer one way or the other, but evidently he liked what I was doing on a small scale and would call me every once in a while. And then suddenly that ended, and I don't know whatever happened to him. And even if he would have given me some of the tips on Casey's ponies, would have done me any good, because I was raising six kids and had a family, and I didn't have any money to put in the stock market, even if he'd have given me great tips. Well, if you're a Walmart shopper, you might want to know about this, influence peddling. The Walton Family Foundation, run by the descendants of Sam Walton, Walmart's founder, is the largest donor to the ultra-Orthodox umbrella organization, Agadath Israel of America, the Forward reports. Most of the money goes to support public money for private schools. The foundation is pushing for charter schools and vouchers, and who knows what else, since Walmart's probably the Waltons are the most richest people, and the corporation's the richest corporation in the country. I imagine they're giving a hell of a lot of money to the Israel cause. And the latest from New York City. New York City developer plans to create a so-called poor door entrance for affordable housing residents in a luxury condo, an arrangement that critics slammed as fundamentally at odds with Jewish ethics. The city officials have signed off on an Extel development company's controversial plan to cut off lower-income renters from those paying top dollar in one of its luxury condominiums on Riverside Drive on Manhattan's Upper West Side, the New York Post reported. Quote, I'm appalled that this arrangement passed muster, New York Assemblyman Linda Rosenthal, whose district includes the new development, told the Forward. It sends a horrible message to hardworking New Yorkers that somehow they're second-class citizens, unquote. Extel, which is owned by Orthodox Jewish real estate mogul Gary Barnett, plans to include 55 affordable housing units in its new 33-story high-rise in order to qualify for the city's inclusionary housing program. Under the program, developers are granted the rights to develop extra floor space, but only if they also build lower-income housing units on the sites and elsewhere. The rent-protected residents of Extel's development will occupy apartments facing the street, while their wealthier neighbors will take in the views of the Hudson River. But it's the idea of a separate access door that has proven particularly divisive. Quote, if they could just walk through the main door, that would solve a lot of issues, Rosenthal said. Why do they have to walk through a different door? Duh. As if people of greater means would not want to associate with people who make less money. Duh. Rosenthal sees the poor door issue as part of a larger move by landlords to deny rent-regulated tenants access to building amenities like gyms, roof decks, and free shuttles. She is currently pushing a bill that would fine landlords $25,000 and prevent them from raising rent until they give their poorer residents access to the amenities. I guess they don't want to let the niggers in the pool. You know that probably a good share of these so-called poor are not going to be white. Probably only a very small percentage. A separate bill, also sponsored by Rosenthal, calls for affordable units to be equally distributed throughout buildings, which would make separate entrances an impossibility. So the guy's going to spend a fortune on an apartment, and the next door neighbor's going to be a nigger, a street nigger, yeah. Oh, man, it gets crazier all the time. It's crazy, man. Mayor Bill de Blasio's administration has not opposed the Extel plan, but says it wants to avoid poor doors in the future. Officials noted that the condo was approved initially during Mayor Michael Bloomberg's reign, the big Jew boy. Quote, this specific project was given a green light by the previous administration and had multiple stories already built by the time we walked in the door, de Blasio spokesman Wiley Norville told Next City. Well, here's what we've got. We had the Jew mayor, the billionaire mayor, and then we have these super rich developing Jews. They're all a bunch of Jews, and they're trying to put on a happy face for the poor and the downtrodden, but they're elitism shines through. A spokesman for Extel, now remember, the guy that runs Extel is an Orthodox Jew, declined to comment on the matter, but papers submitted with the company's application suggest that it views the separate entrance as legal necessity. It claims the floors devoted to affordable housing are actually part of a separate building, which requires its own entrance under city zoning rules. Oh, they got their tit in the ringer on this one. Gary Barnett, Extel's owner, was born Gershon Swatsky and grew up in ultra-Orthodox enclaves of the Lower East Side of Manhattan and Muncie, New Jersey, according to the New York Magazine. He has 10 children and is himself the son of an esteemed Talmud scholar. Elisa Golden, a young Jewish tenant organizer, is troubled by the plan put forward by Barnett and Extel's plan. Quote, as a Jew, I don't think it's within Jewish values to be blatantly discriminatory or making people feel lesser, she said, noting that Barnett is not the first Jewish real estate developer under fire for incontroversial real estate practices. No, they constitute most of the slumlords. Quote, on the other hand, there are a lot of Jewish organizers and Jewish people who are working on the other side of the issue, who are using Jewish values to say we're fighting for justice. Yeah, you see how that works? Control both sides of every argument. Yeah, that's the point. Let's see here. Two of the prominent opponents of the Extel plan are Jewish politicians Rosenthal and city council member Mark Levine. There's so many Jews in New York, now they fight among themselves, you know. The chair of the council's Jewish caucus. Gee, they don't have an Aryan caucus up there, do they? They've got a Jewish caucus who has sponsored a bill that would protect rent-regulated tenants from discrimination. I love it. Orthodox activist Rabbi Ari Hart also takes issue with the Extel plan. Quote, when you hear stuff like this, it makes you think. What are our societal priorities, said Hart, who co-founded the Orthodox social justice group Uri L. Zedek. Quote, things like this rob us of the opportunity to recognize the shared humanity of all people, rich and poor alike, and it does a disservice to all New Yorkers. That's the end of the story, man. The Jews are all fighting among themselves because they don't want nigger neighbors or even poor white people. Well, I see Upper Michigan's up and at it. Racism on display in a bizarre march in Vassar, Michigan. The ugly side of patriotism was on display last week in Vassar, a shabby little town in Michigan's thumb. 50 or so heroes, bizarrely, carried flags, automatic rifles, and handguns on a short march in a sugar beet country. They had hard faces. They had a woman with wispy blonde hair as their leader, and 100% American cause. They were determined to prevent a local human services facility from helping some poor, frightened refugee children. Quote, we're not against children, claims Tamra Murray, the self-styled leader of the Michiganders for Immigration Control and Enforcement, a group best appropriately abbreviated as MICE. Well, why didn't she say we're not against children except non-white children? Want to bring some white children in here? I'm sure we can find some. Whites from Ukraine and so forth. Quote, but the children here are only pawns. They're a game to control our nation. It's an invasion, nothing less than an invasion, she said, delighting her scuffy band of followers. Well, to the unsophisticated like me, a bunch of hungry 9-year-olds doesn't quite look like Omaha Beach. Oh, but collectively they do. But Tammy knows her geopolitical strategy all right and has the background to prove it. Why, according to her LinkedIn profile, she spent 17 years as a mostly non-union plasterer. Well, there's something wrong with being a non-union plasterer. Then she moved on to become a caulker. That's great if you love grout, but doesn't get you a lot of FaceTime on the news. So Murray reinvented herself as liaison public speaker and set out to save America from the mongrel hordes. Well, that's great. I like this. She dabbled in anti-invasion issues, but finally found her chance. Since last fall, thousands of refugee children, mostly from Central America, have stumbled across our borders, mainly due to U.S. intervention in South America militarily. I suppose if President Obama had been a red-blooded American patriot, he would have set up machine guns and hosed them all as they tried to cross the border. But he is, of course, a Kenyan socialist Muslim. And even worse, he's black. So at least in the view of the gun waivers of Vassar, he spit upon our heritage and gave these children shelter. Now they want to bring a few dozen of the little boys to Vassar. Not to roam the streets and pray about women and cows in town. Well, I'm sure they probably will be praying pretty soon after, once they see all the goodies they can steal. Not exactly. They would be housed in a now vacant building at Wolverine Human Services Pioneer Work and Learn Center, a social service agency for children based in Grosse Pointe Park. Well, what about all the U.S. citizens and white citizens, people who are living in their automobiles because they don't have a job and don't have a house? The federal government, not the locals, would absorb the costs. What do you mean, the federal? It's, we pay for the whole thing. You know, I always get a kick out of that. The federal government, not the locals, would absorb the cost. Who do you think pays the money for the federal to have any money at all? Then the kids would move on. Some would go to invasion courts to see if they could qualify to stay. A lucky few would be reunited with relatives who already are already here. Some, sadly, might end up being deported. Well, anyhow, it goes on from there. Trying to make people who are against the invasion look like horrible people. But those who want everybody in the world to slither across the borders, they're wonderful humanitarian, Jesus-loving people. I'm going to close out the show now, but I'm going to record, I forgot to put it on here, from a show from Max Kaiser from yesterday. It was really great because the scam now is, you remember the housing scandal of a few years ago and subprime mortgages and all that? Believe it or not, they moved into the automobile business now, and they're subpriming automobile ownership. And the way it works out is that they're loaning poor people thousands of dollars to buy old clunky cars. For instance, the one guy was loaned $15,000 to buy an old Toyota. This is sweeping the nation. This is the new scam. You got to hear about it. That's it for today. I'll be back tomorrow, hopefully, Thursday. Keep smiling, boys and girls. It's getting better all the time.
The Kaiser Report. I'm Max Kaiser. You know, in July of 2008, just weeks before the collapse of Lehman Brothers took down the financial markets with the bank, and before TARP and ZIRP and NERP George W. Bush was caught on camera at a fundraiser in Houston, Texas, saying, quote, "There is no question about it. Wall Street got drunk. The question is, how long will it take to sober up and not try to do all those fancy financial instruments?" If drunk is code for fraud, then, Georgie, the party was just getting started. Stacey?
Max, Wall Street is drunk again, and actually they're drunk driving, it appears. Tweet from Dealbook, subprime auto loans are bundled and sold by banks to insurance companies, mutual funds, and public pension funds. Well, this is based on an investigation by Dealbook New York Times, and the headline from that investigation, Max, reads, "In a subprime bubble for used cars, borrowers pay sky-high rates. Rodney Durham stopped working in 1991, declared bankruptcy, and lives on Social Security. Nonetheless, Wells Fargo lent him $15,197 to buy a used Mitsubishi sedan. I am not sure how I got the loan," Mr. Durham, age 60, said.
Yeah. It's whack-a-mole comes to mind. You know, they went from the subprime housing, that crashed the economy, as you pointed out, with Lehman Brothers. So now they moved on to autos. You know, it just goes around and around and around. I mean, there's no attempt to stop this from going on. I mean, we can only guess what the next area of fraud will be. But yes, car loans is at the moment the fraud du jour.
Yeah, remember Barack Obama, when he came into office, said we have to look forward. We have to go forward. We cannot look back. The economy needs to recover. We need to continue forward. Now, the stories I'm going to tell you here are the exact same, not a single thing different about the frauds committed in the subprime mortgage market. Here, these are subprime loans, i.e. subprime equals anybody with a credit score less than 640 in America. So these are subprime loans for used cars, not even new cars, used cars. So this guy, Mr. Durham, in this article who received a $15,000 loan, hasn't worked since 1991. The New York Times looked at his loan application form, however, and on the form it was filled in that he earned $35,000 working as a technician at Lord's Hospital in Binghamton, New York. He told, however, the loan officer at Wells Fargo that he hasn't worked since 1991. They just filled it in regardless. Now, remember a lot of the subprime loans for the McMansions in America, what happened? Well, the McDonald's workers received $500,000 loans because somebody filled in that they were earning $60,000, $70,000 as a manager of regional McDonald's.
Right, the liar's loans, as they call them. So I remember going back to the subprime era, you had the fraud committed by various banks. They were fraudulently making loans. They were involved in liar loans. They were involved in selling the book of loans to other institutions fraudulently. They were involved in Goldman Sachs case selling these loans off to their own customers, knowing that they would crash, and then making bets against their own customers. They were misrated by the rating agencies who knowingly engaged in fraud to give these packages of fraudulent loans AAA ratings. They were manipulated by hedge funds who were trading on inside information. They were bailed out by Hank Paulson, who was also trading on inside information and holding the American economy hostage for that huge $750 billion bailout fund, which became $20 trillion. So the fraud is replete throughout every aspect of the economy, the rating agencies, the government, the Wall Street banks, the hedge funds, and the media, of course, in this case CNBC, who tied the whole thing up in a ribbon and handed it over to the American public in a big turd sandwich. So what was the result of this? Wall Street moved on to auto loans. Now you have the exact same thing all over again. Fraudulent loans made based on liar loans. They'll take all those car loans and package them off to institutions and pension funds where it'll blow up and cause people to be impoverished. It will be rated by rating agencies in a way that's completely fraudulent.
Well, in fact, you're predicting in the next few quotes I have, because all of that, that's talking exactly about that. So these loans have increased by 130% since the financial crisis. So one in four loans, auto loans, is now a subprime mortgage, a mortgage on a car, essentially, because they're actually like the length of a mortgage now. So what's driving this? The article in the New York Times points out exactly as you've been saying, actually, but we'll say it here as well. The explosive growth is being driven by some of the same dynamics that were at work in subprime mortgages. A wave of money is pouring into subprime autos as the high rates and steady profits of the loans attracts investors. Just as Wall Street stoked the boom in mortgages, some of the nation's biggest banks and private equity firms are feeding the growth in subprime auto loans by investing in lenders and making money available for loans. So again, the banks have a one step removed, so they'll never get in trouble. It's just the middleman. They're extending these loans, this money to these intermediaries who give the subprime auto loan directly to the customer. And then what are these private equity and banks doing? Well, according to the article, and like subprime mortgages before the financial crisis, many subprime auto loans are bundled into complex bonds and sold as securities by banks to insurance companies, mutual funds, and public pension funds, a process that creates ever greater demand for loans. We know all of this, what happened with the subprime mortgage thing, but we should just move forward. Don't really examine this, because we already know we have to move past this. We can't hold people accountable, because we need to make the economy continue to grow.
Right. I mean, that's the logic behind it. That's the those are the talking points, or the propaganda, as it's cooked up by Wall Street and spewed by CNBC, a network of financial propaganda. And, you know, I thought, though, that the financial soft spot would be what was happening in the student loan market. Because, remember, we were reporting a few months ago on the exact same thing happening in the student loan market, which has become a $1 trillion mortgage fraud type market that was set to explode or implode or ripple through the economy in this way. But apparently this auto loan fraud has kind of snuck in ahead of the student loan fraud.
Well, the thing about the student loan is you owe the government can owns you, the person, the student. They'll take whatever. They can seize your bank accounts, seize your income, seize your IRS tax returns, so you're forever stuck there. Here, the companies are repossessing the cars from these people and driving them into bankruptcy, and also packaging them into complex bonds, all of these subprime auto loans. None of these student loans are being packaged and sold to pension funds like these. These are pension funds are being sold, these subprime auto loans. But remarkably, they also point out that interest rates on these subprime auto loans can exceed 23%, and the loans were typically at least twice the size of the value of the used cars purchased, including dozens of battered vehicles with mechanical defects hidden from borrowers. Such loans can thrust already vulnerable borrowers further into debt, even propelling some into bankruptcy. So the New York Times found out this information by going to bankruptcy court and looking at the bankruptcy filings to see who was being driven into bankruptcy by these subprime auto loans. And there was a remarkable number of them, and many of them because they were not only given these subprime high interest rate mortgage, I keep on saying mortgages, but they are, in a way, the auto loans, and yet a lot of them were dodgy cars.
So, of course, when this blows up, as it inevitably will, then the media and Wall Street will blame the victims, will blame the people who took out the loans, just like they blamed the people who took out the mortgages during the subprime crisis, even though it was institutionalized fraud geared toward disenfranchisement and a certain financial bludgeoning that took place, and people were bleeding out of every orifice of their financial being. They were blamed for the fact that they were ganged up on by financial folks and you know, taken advantage of unmercifully. So the car loan loan recipients will be similarly abused when this all blows up. And, you know, as we've been predicting or we've been saying, I mean, it's just the cycle repeats itself because there's no deterrent for fraud. Interest rates are too low, so it encourages malinvestment. There's no oversight. There's no SEC. There's no regulatory body that's worth its salt. The financial media is corrupt and full of propaganda. And the rating agencies are completely corrupt, and the hedge funds are trading inside information and completely corrupt.
I mean, remember, Obama said we have to move forward, we can't look back. Wells Fargo, as the New York Times pointed out, with the very first sentence of this story, is the one that loaned $15,000 to this guy who hasn't had a job since 1991. Wells Fargo is one of the biggest participants in the subprime mortgage disaster.
Right. Well, Wells Fargo is one of the too big to fail banks that, as a result of the last crisis, got even too bigger to fail or even bigger to fail. And when this blows up, there'll be another consolidation wave into banks. They'll become even much bigger behemoths of fraud with no competition. Here's the thing about it that is really destructive to the American economy is that it discourages competition. And America really can't move forward unless there's competition. And there's less and less competition, especially in the banking sector, which is being consolidated into ultimately one or two players. There'll be J.P. Morgan and, you know, Wells Fargo, which is Warren Buffett's little pet bank. And everyone else will have been consumed by these two big banks, and they'll engage in monopoly extraction of wealth. And so there's nothing left.
So the rating agencies, as you've mentioned, have been rating these bonds, these complex bonds that have been sold to the pension funds. They've been giving them their blessing, but at the same time protecting themselves by warning people that there are way too many of these subprime auto loans, and it looks dodgy and it looks scary. But despite these warnings, the volume of total subprime auto loans increased roughly 15% to $145.6 billion in the first 3 months of the year from a year earlier, according to Experian, a credit rating firm. So as soon as you point out to the investing community that here is a problem, of course, what do? They accelerate their loans because they know, oh my God, this is great, because it's obviously too big to fail. It's obviously going to be an impending disaster. This means we're guaranteed that the Fed and the government will come in and swoop in and bail us out, because this is a critical, vulnerable point.
Well, the people who are taking these car loans, of course, to make the payments, they have a cost structure at the end of the month that's contingent upon gas prices being low. American gas prices are some of the lowest in the world. But given the geopolitics at the moment, I would posit that that is about to change. So if you're suddenly paying $8, $9, $10 a gallon for gas, then you will most certainly default on your car loan, triggering another Lehman-style collapse and another huge banking consolidation and another loss of competition and liberty in the United States. So it's a foregone conclusion driven by artificially low rates and corruption in every single sector, including the media.
Now, I did see a statistic just published on, I think it was the Wall Street Journal today, that the average American wealth is still down 50%. Their aggregate wealth, all their holdings, their pension fund, everything, since the financial crisis. So here we are at this point where it's like become a junkyard. I mean, this is like even lower than houses. This is like people who are living in their cars, you know, that were forced into their cars from the previous thing. Plus, you have no public
infrastructure. Maybe that's why you keep saying mortgages, is because people are going to be ending up moving into their cars.
Well, yeah.
And they're living in their cars. So for them, this is their mortgage because that's where they live.
Well, exactly. But so once this crashes, because all of the pension funds have been buying these subprime auto loans, I was surprised that it's as big as $145 billion worth in one quarter.
Woohoo! That's a big number. Okay, well, we got to go. See you soon. Bye now. All right, stay tuned for the second half, an interview I did with Jan Squire.